This episode is brought to you by Accounting Plus. We've heard about career killers, but how about a killer career? Accounting has got it all. You'll have flexibility, great pay, and the kind of lifestyle you've always dreamed of. If that's not enough, you'll have the opportunity to make a difference by using your detective skills to investigate financial mysteries. Want in? Accounting Plus provides free resources that'll help guide you to a successful career in accounting and personal freedom. Do more. Live more. Visit joinaccountingplus.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. Now, enjoy the show.
The inclination to murder came to me as naturally as the inspiration to do right comes to the majority of persons. Where others' hearts were touched with pity, mine filled with cruelty. And where in others the feeling was to save life, I reveled in the thoughts of destroying them. Not only that, I was not satisfied in taking it in the ordinary way. I sought devices strange, fantastical, and even grotesque. It pleased my fancy. It gave me play to work my murderous will, and I reveled in it with the enthusiasm of an alchemist who is hot on the trail of the Philosopher's Stone.
Welcome to Serial Killers, where we take a look into the minds of the most notorious serial killers around the globe. I'm Greg Polson, and I'll be your host during this investigation. Today, we continue with our psychological profile of H.H. Holmes, one of the world's first recorded serial killers. If you want to listen to any episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all on your favorite podcast directory. Don't forget to subscribe. You can also listen on our website, Parcast.com, spelled Parcast.com. A new episode comes out every Monday. Visit our Facebook page, Parcast, to join the conversation. So far, we've learned that Holmes has definitively killed 6 people, perhaps dozens more, and his primary targets have been young women. We've also seen his primary methods of killing have been poisoning or asphyxiation. As for his psychological profile, well, I'll leave that to Vanessa. Vanessa will be answering questions I have about the mental makeup of a serial killer, what makes them tick, what molded them, and what their thought process is like. It's important to note that she's not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but like me, she's fascinated by the psychology of serial killers and has done a lot of research for the show. Vanessa, thanks for joining us again.
Glad to be of help.
Would you mind giving us a summary of Holmes' psychological state so far?
Of course. So far, we've started to form the theory that Holmes was a psychopath who saw his victims as little more than tools to make money. On top of that, we took a peek into his childhood, where we learned how abuse may have played into his victim selection, noting that female victims were easy targets, which made him feel powerful in the face of the powerlessness he felt as a child.
However, Holmes' pattern of killing young female victims changed when he killed his right-hand man, Benjamin Peitzel, on September 2, 1894. The two had decided upon a plan to fake Peitzel's death to collect a $10,000 insurance payout. But instead of faking his death, Holmes killed his partner by burning him alive. After Peitzel's death, Holmes carried on with the plan. He arranged to collect the insurance payout, telling Peitzel's wife that the plan had gone successfully and that Peitzel was hiding out in London, ready to meet her when the time came.
I'm here to collect the insurance money for my husband, the late Mr. Perry.
Oh yes, Mrs. Perry. I heard about the accident. I'm so sorry. I wish the best for you and your children. Here you go. Just fill out the form here.
Thank you.
Little did she know, however, that when she went to collect the insurance money from her fake husband, she was actually collecting it for her real one. But why did Holmes kill his partner in crime? As a reminder, Holmes once said of Peitzel,
"He's too valuable a man, even with his failings taken into account, for me to dispense of him."
So why the change? Was it really all just a ploy for money like all his other victims?
Well, the scheme does align with Holmes' previous murders. In fact, given what we've learned about Holmes so far, it seems more ridiculous to assume he would actually fake Peitzel's death rather than just kill him. Peitzel was valuable to Holmes, but only until he was no longer useful.
I suppose this does make sense based on some later evidence. One district attorney would later note,
"Mr. Peitzel was Holmes' tool, his creature."
That seems to make more sense given the situation. The only difference with Peitzel's murder is that Holmes' MO changed. Prior to this, we've had no indication that he killed men or that he's killed by burning someone alive.
Let's talk a little more about MO.
A modus operandi, or MO, refers to the steps the serial killer needs to take in order to physically carry out the act of the crime.
For example, the killer may need chloroform to knock out his victims or a knife to kill them, right?
Right. And we should be careful to not get this confused with a killer's signature. A signature is not required for the actual murder, but fuels the psychological or emotional need of the kill. In simpler terms, it's the reason for the murder.
So far, we've seen Holmes' MO change a lot. He's poisoned, suffocated, asphyxiated, and even set fire to his victims. Why might Holmes have so many variations in his MO?
Oftentimes, the change in MO correlates to the killer finding a better method of performing their task. For instance, they might find that handcuffs are easier to bind their victims with than rope, or that disposing of a body in a river is more efficient than burying them.
For Holmes, though, it seems that his MO wasn't evolving, but was flipping back and forth between different methods. Was it out of convenience, you think?
It is possible that his change in MO was based on convenience of whatever worked best in that particular time. But with Holmes, I suspect at least part of it was that he simply enjoyed killing in different ways. He was still human, and humans crave novelty, sick as that implication is.
I guess the fact that he built an entire castle devoting to killing does speak to that theory.
Holmes himself did say he enjoyed experimenting with different methods of killing.
Okay. So his MO included choosing people that lived in or around the castle, usually female, and killing them by poison, suffocation, or asphyxiation.
And his signature was most likely that he needed to obtain something of monetary value in order to make the kill.
Which brings us back to his latest kill, the murder of his right-hand man, Benjamin Peitzel. In the case of Peitzel, his signature definitely seems evident. By killing his friend, he was able to easily get the insurance money. We've already talked a little bit about how it's not out of character for Holmes to have killed Peitzel, but I still wonder if Holmes felt any remorse in killing his partner.
Well, considering that he's killed several lovers at this point, it doesn't seem like emotional attachment played much into his consideration.
It seems like it's becoming more and more likely that Holmes was, in fact, a psychopath.
He does exhibit many of the traits associated with psychopaths. Emotional detachment, seeing people as tools, displaying a lack of remorse.
I definitely agree with him being remorseless, considering what Holmes did next. After he killed Peitzel and collected the insurance money, he told Mrs. Peitzel that he was safe and waiting for her, but that she needed to follow his instructions in order to ensure the plan went through and they could all be safe.
"Follow my instructions closely, do you understand? Mr. Peitzel's safety relies on your being very careful."
"Of course. I wouldn't dare do a thing to put him in harm's way."
"I know you wouldn't, but..."
"What is it?"
"I'm worried for the children. I'm afraid you won't be able to keep up with all five of them in tow. Give me keep of the younger ones. I'll keep them safe."
I'm not so sure about that."
It's for their safety, Mrs. Peitzel. You know Benjamin would have wanted the same. You would draw less attention this way, too.
All right. I never did understand how you managed all your plots, but I trust you to be a careful man. I'll wait for your word, then.
Somehow, he convinced her to give him custody of 3 of the 5 children, Howard, Alice, and Nellie, none of whom knew about the insurance plot and thus thought their father was actually dead. For some time, Holmes traveled between cities around the U.S., the 3 children in tow. At the same time, he sent instructions to Carrie Peitzel on where to stay and what their next steps were.
Mrs. Peitzel, find enclosed the address to your next safe house. I've called ahead and ensured you'll have your privacy. I've just received word that your husband has been set up in London and is doing fine. The location of the hotel is 446 Main Street, on the south side of the city. I've taken the liberty of preparing a new residence in Philadelphia. I promise to meet up with you soon. Don't have to worry about a thing. Signed, H.H.
She was completely unaware of where Holmes and her children were, despite the fact that they were sometimes staying at hotels but a block away from each other. This lasted some time, but suddenly Holmes' plan took a sharp left. Why he chose this moment or this place to enact the next stage of his plan, we can't be sure. But what he did was truly terrifying. He began to kill the children off. The first child he targeted was 8-year-old Howard Peitzel. Holmes recounts his murder in one of his confessions.
I called at the Irvington drugstore and purchased the drugs I needed to kill the boy. After I came back, I called him into the house and insisted that he go to bed at once.
Howard!
Before doing so, I gave him the fatal dose of medicine. And as soon as he had ceased to breathe, I cut his body into pieces that would pass through the door of the stove, and by the combined use of gas and corn cobs, proceeded to burn it. I had little feelings in that moment. It felt as though it had been some inanimate object.
Howard's sisters were blissfully unaware of what happened to their brother. In one of her letters home, Alice wrote simply,
Howard is not with us now.
Of course, Holmes never sent any of the letters Alice wrote and instead kept them hidden away in a tin box. Less than a month later, in late October, Holmes took Alice and Nellie to Toronto. While staying in a safe house, he enticed them to hide in one of the large storage trunks, where he locked them inside and left the house.
After 8 p.m., I returned to the house where the children were imprisoned and ended their lives by connecting a gas line into the trunk. Then came the opening of the trunk and the viewing of their little blackened and distorted faces. Then came the digging of their shallow graves in the basement of the house. The ruthless stripping off of their clothing and the burial without a particle of covering save the cold earth, which I heaped upon them with fiendish delight.
Why did he kill the 3 children? Was it to cover up his plot and ensure no one would find out he killed Benjamin Peitzel? Or did he simply need to kill? Let's bring it back to Vanessa.
It might have been that he simply needed to kill. He was used to having easy access to victims in the castle, but out on the road, he didn't have as many opportunities. If killing was a craving, then like an overdue volcano, he was probably ready to explode.
I guess that makes sense. If the predictions about his victim count being in the hundreds are true, then he was probably killing people on a fairly regular basis.
Though even if he was at his breaking point and needed to kill, he still seemed to execute his plan as carefully as he would other murders.
That's true. Not only did he burn Howard's body to cover his tracks, he also cut off Nellie's club feet to prevent people from identifying that it was her. And with the 3 Peitzel children's deaths, we were also introduced to a new, darker element with Holmes' case. His straightforward declaration of killing for fun, without remorse.
He was nothing more than an inanimate object. I buried the girls with fiendish delight.
To me, this seems pretty concretely like the thoughts of a psychopathic killer. Do you perhaps have any other explanations?
No, I'd agree with you on that one. Given how many people he had killed already, it doesn't seem to me like a coping mechanism for keeping himself sane while doing something terrible, but simply the way he viewed the world.
One interesting tidbit to note, though, was that after Holmes had killed Howard and was still traveling with Alice and Nellie, he made a pit stop in Detroit, where he met up with Carrie Peitzel and her two other children. There he planted explosives in an attempt to kill her, but he was unsuccessful in his plan and quickly left. Knowing that he also tried to kill Carrie Peitzel, does it seem more likely he was trying to cover up his murder plot?
Well, the rest of this plan does seem out of character in comparison to his other murders. They were all far more cruel and risky than his previous ones at the castle, and the fact that he was moving from city to city indicates that he never quite felt safe where he was.
It does seem pretty likely that he was afraid he'd be caught. Peitzel did know the scam, after all. And maybe he was afraid that she would find out that her husband was really dead and turn Holmes in.
Perhaps he knew he was on his last legs. He certainly did go through a lot to ensure the children's bodies were well hidden.
But was it desperation or just sadism?
As we keep seeing with Holmes, it's never just one or the other.
You're right. But either way, Holmes was not going to be running rampant for much longer. Though he had managed to kill off Benjamin Peitzel and three of his children, all the while successfully tricking Carrie Peitzel into thinking that her husband and children were alive and perfectly fine, this wild string of murders spelled disaster for Holmes. And I'm sure he never expected to be caught for these gruesome crimes by a small loose thread in his plan. Marion Hedgepeth, the man who gave him the name of the dirty lawyer on the plan.
Marion Hedgepeth. All right. What's this matter you so urgently needed to talk to the police about?
I've got a tip on someone. Someone you'd be very interested about, I think.
Well, get on with it. We didn't pull you out of your cell for you to lollygag along.
He called himself H.M. Howard. Pulled in for horse theft or something like that. We struck up a deal, see, and he hasn't held up his end of the bargain. See, I'm a mighty generous fellow, but the poor lot I am, I've been taken advantage of. The police ought not stand for something like that.
Are you asking the police to play enforcer on your illegal dealings?
No, nothing like that. I'm trying to stop a terrible criminal. I want to help you.
Yes, I'm sure that's the reason.
I told you, I'm a very generous man.
I'm guessing your generosity comes at a price.
Well, we all need to live, don't we?
Well, what is it?
I want my sentence pardoned.
That's 11 years you're talking about.
I'm aware.
You must be real confident about this tip.
Oh, it's an awfully good one. Worth much more than a measly 500 bucks.
Holmes, in typical fashion, never lived up to his promise to pay Marion the $500. And as a result, Marion turned against Holmes and told the police about Holmes' insurance scheme in exchange for getting out early on his own sentence.
In light of his help in the recent murder case by which we are all shocked and appalled by, I hereby pardon Mr. Marion Hedgepeth of his crimes and request his immediate release from prison.
The police arrested Holmes in Boston on November 17, 1894, and held him on an outstanding warrant of horse theft in Texas. He reportedly tried to get out of the situation by bribing the detective that was bringing him in.
I'm a hypnotizer. If you let me hypnotize you so that we can escape, I'll give you $500.
Hypnotism always spoils my appetite.
Holmes' tricks had lost their power. He was done with killing, but his story still had a few crazy twists and turns before it hit the end of his course, starting with turning him into a household name. Holmes' story made headlines across America. Here was a man of scandal and schemes revealed at last as a crook. But it wasn't just his cons that were laid out on the table. Soon his castle and all the murders that took place within it would be rolled out for the public eye. While Chicago police tore apart the murder castle, one Philadelphia detective, Frank Geyer, heard about the case and was instantly worried about the Peitzel children. Fearing something may have happened to them, he embarked on a quest to track them down. The case was huge. In fact, it began to grow so big that Detective Geyer's investigation was broadcast daily across national newspapers, and he was even given the nickname, the American Sherlock Holmes.
Detective Geyer makes his way through Illinois on new lead.
American Sherlock Holmes discovers new clue in Peitzel disappearance.
Geyer discovers new evidence regarding Peitzel children.
Breakthrough, new evidence for Geyer, our star-spangled Detective Holmes.
On July 15, 1895, after over a month of investigation, Detective Geyer discovered the bodies of the two Peitzel girls. Then, on August 27th, he discovered the remains of Howard Peitzel in the chimney of the house where Holmes killed him.
Detective Geyer, our very own American Sherlock Holmes, has found evidence of a fourth body in the terrifying murder case said to be perpetrated by Chicago businessman H.H. Holmes.
Meanwhile, while Detective Geyer was tracking down the bodies of the Peitzel family, the police in Chicago were tearing apart Holmes' castle in an attempt to find clues of what really happened. As with Geyer, their investigations were eagerly eaten up by the public. But unlike Geyer, they were less like Sherlock Holmes and more like bumbling Inspector Clouseau. In fact, their investigations took so many odd and morbidly hilarious turns that they became a joke in the eyes of the public. As the police began investigating the murder castle, they kept suggesting new ways in which Holmes might have killed his victims. And each time, they were more wrong than the time before. Their first suspicion was that Holmes burned his victims in the large stoves hidden in the basement of the castle, which Holmes allegedly built for the purpose of glass blowing, though he was never seen to have blown any glass or show any products from the time. They found bits of bone in the oven, which turned out to not actually be bone, just lumps of clay. Forensics experts also noted that the stove wouldn't have been able to get hot enough to burn bodies. After tossing that theory aside, police moved on to their next theory, that Holmes hung his victims in a three-story drop known as the death shaft. They found a long length of bloody rope near the shaft, which they believe he might have used for hangings. However, the blood on the rope proved to be just chemical stains that left a red residue, and the length of the rope deemed far too long to be convenient for hangings. Following that, they found what they assumed to be bloodied undergarments in a barrel in the basement.
It's blood!
Which again, turned out not to be blood. By this time, the public was starting to get frustrated with the police reports. One Chicago newspaper, the Inter-Ocean, ran a rather snarky article.
How did H.H. Holmes dispose of his victims? This is the conundrum that has driven to desperation Chief Badnock and the sleuths of the police department. The first day, it was demonstrated by the detectives beyond the shadow of a doubt that the victims were cremated in a small office stove. The next day, it was conclusively established that instead of a stove, it was a huge crematory in the basement. 24 hours later, it was absolutely proved that none of the bodies were ever burned, but instead they were buried in the quicklime in the cellar of the castle. Before the sun had set upon that day, all previous theories were disproved by the irrefutable fact that the bodies were placed in big tanks filled with acid.
The report goes on to proverbially roll eyes at the police department, ending on this rather poignant tidbit.
But several young boys uncovered the mystery in the Holmes case. They had it with them. It was a six-cornered kite, 8 feet high, and on both sides of it was printed in big letters the following.
This is H.H. Holmes's kite, and it is believed by police to be the kite which he used to dispose of his victims.
Perhaps all this nonsense floating around is why Holmes remained so calm during the investigation. In fact, while the police were investigating the castle, Holmes started writing a lengthy autobiography called Holmes' Own Story, clearing himself of all guilt. He also gave a few interviews, one with a popular New York newspaper called The New York Woman.
I do not deny that appearances are against me, but believe me, I never took the life of a fellow being. Why should I do so? What motive would I have had? None whatsoever.
Well, people are talking nonetheless.
I had responsibilities that most men would not have shouldered. I helped my parents, I helped my relatives. At one time I can show that I had 26 persons dependent on me for support. If I had the mania for murder with which I am credited, why would I do this? The rich corporations were my prey, and I justified myself by the thought that the rich in their turn were robbing the poor.
Ironically, despite the evidence that was slowly stacking up, people were in disbelief. Dr. Robinson, who ran Holmes' drugstore, said,
I always believed that he would be too cautious to do a thing that would be likely to land him in prison. And I had my doubts about him murdering the girl.
Mrs. Kress, one of the residents of the castle, also spoke in favor of him.
I can scarcely believe that Mr. Holmes is guilty of all the charges they brought against him. I must say that whatever his faults may have been, he had some good qualities. No one could have been kinder to us than he was when my husband was sick with typhoid fever.
Although many knew of his money-making schemes, he was still a respected figure. In fact, he might have thought himself to be safe because of this. He even wrapped up his interview with a new woman with a rather bold answer.
Do you believe the old theory that murder will always reveal itself?
Yes, indeed I do. And I can truly say that. I believe very few murders go unpunished. Sooner or later, the murderer will betray himself.
Our story will continue in a moment after a brief message.
This episode is brought to you by Accounting Plus. We've heard about career killers, but how about a killer career? Accounting has got it all. You'll have flexibility, great pay, and the kind of lifestyle you've always dreamed of. If that's not enough, you'll have the opportunity to make a difference by using your detective skills to investigate financial mysteries. Want in? Accounting Plus provides free resources that'll help guide you to a successful career in accounting and personal freedom. Do more. Live more. Visit joinaccountingplus.com. And now, let's continue our story.
It's interesting, as a guilty man, Holmes would say what he did.
It seems even more obvious now that he was convinced he would be acquitted. Either that, or he was intentionally foreshadowing his own future.
We often see these stereotypes of serial killers who toy with the police and public by blatantly waving evidence in their face or playing word games to throw them for a loop. Do you think that stereotype applies here?
He is someone who's experimented with different ways to kill people and trick them out of their property, but he tended to be pretty covert about that. He always made sure to create alibis and keep his secrets hidden. At this stage, while it could be an internal joke, it seems more likely that he's trying to prove his innocence.
Either way, Holmes' confidence in getting away with his murder would soon be crushed. After several failed attempts to find evidence at Holmes' castle, the police finally found a concrete lead. In the basement of the castle, buried 18 inches beneath the ground, they found a bloody undergarment, a scrap of clothing likely belonging to an adult female. And unlike previous suppositions, this one actually did have blood on it. Detective Fitzpatrick, one of the leads on the case, spoke about the success.
What do you think of the latest developments, Detective?
This undergarment appears to show plainly that something unusual must have happened to them. Those stains are surely blood. From their appearance, I should say the garment was used to sop up several pools. Those stains could not have been made any other way.
Do you think there remains any further reason for continuing the search?
I certainly do. Why, this thing is getting deeper and deeper every day. I should not be surprised now to find a skeleton at any time.
He had no idea how right he was about to be. In the following days, the police team began digging up the basement of the castle, and what they found pushed their case forward by leaps and bounds.
Several ribs protruded from the earth after about 2 feet of dirt had been dug away at the corner of the east and south walls. Upon digging carefully around with their hands, the detectives took out 7 ribs, several sections of vertebra, and a piece of bone from a fractured upper jaw. Upon digging further, several more ribs were found, and a portion of a woman's jacket, and a bunch of matted hair. Too much discolored to ascertain its original hue.
The jacket was presumed to be that of Julia Connor, Holmes' first victim, while the bones were that of Pearl Connor, Julia's daughter and his second victim. They also found several strands of hair in the basement that were thought to belong to Minnie and Anna Williams, the two sisters that Holmes convinced to give him all their property before killing them. Finally, the police were getting somewhere. But Holmes was still in complete denial. Around the time the police finished investigating the castle, Holmes released his murder-denying autobiography, in which he explained away the deaths of his alleged victims with stories equal parts scandalous and absurd. First, he talked about the death of Anna Williams.
While Anna was visiting us in Chicago, she became enamored with me. I could not help it, nor did I do anything to lead her on. But Minnie nonetheless became struck with jealousy. In a fit of rage, she killed her own sister. She suffered from nervous breakdowns after that, and was institutionalized several times. It was her, in fact, that stole away the Peitzel children and headed to London, where I believe she started a massage establishment with Edward Hatch.
Edward Hatch was a made-up person Holmes cited in many of the stories in his book, claiming that it was Hatch, not him, that was the perpetrator of all these nefarious acts. He also explained Benjamin Peitzel's death in an interesting manner.
Oh, my dear friend took his own life. He left behind a suicide note, which I burned at his request. In it were his instructions. He wished me to arrange his body in one of two ways that it would appear that his death had been either accidental or that he had been attacked by burglars and killed. He did not want his family to know of his death, and he especially did not want his children to know he had committed suicide.
His stories were ridiculous, yet he wrote this confession with utter conviction. It makes me wonder what would compel him to lie so completely about the situation. Vanessa, what do you think?
At this point, he probably was doing all he could to find a way out of prison and a way to avoid the death sentence. Given that the police were bumbling about, he might have even thought that he had a pretty good chance of getting out unscathed.
It is true that a lot of people believe this. One employee did say,
"From my knowledge of the man and his methods, I feel certain he will never be brought to trial. He has many resources, and if he ever has half a chance, he will make his escape and fool them yet."
But despite everyone's confidence in him, Holmes' stories were simply too absurd for the public to believe. Prior to this, he demonstrated his intelligence and careful planning when handling his kills. Why do you think he would essentially jump the shark in his own story? Does this indicate desperation on Holmes' part?
Now that he was completely in the limelight, he wasn't thinking as straight as before. He was afraid he would be convicted for his murders and was panicking, trying to find a way out wherever he could, even with ridiculous stories.
Perhaps he must have realized how silly it all looked. In fact, Holmes didn't hold on to these convictions for very long. After the police investigation came up with more concrete evidence, Holmes took up an offer from a local newspaper. He took money in exchange for a full-fledged confession, complete with confessing to 27 different murders. And in case you're wondering, that's where all Holmes' quotes in this and last episode came from.
"This confession, this terrible record of slaughter made by the man himself, and over which he seems to gloat as he leaps from word to word in the written recollection of his blood deeds, at last tells the true story of this murderer's life, his motive, and the dark inspiration that led him to choose a life to devoted absolutely and fervidly to the pursuit of murder."
Holmes' confession was a graphic, terrifying tale of his murders, sparing no bloody detail, and using words so vile that entire sections of his confession were censored in the papers for fear of backlash among readers.
"Words so strong it compels us, for the sake of our readers, to leave out the more gruesome of details. Besides our omissions, everything you find here is exactly as written by the fiend himself."
However, the most intriguing part of the confession was that a large chunk of it was entirely false. There were two victims he noted in his confession who he simply made up. There weren't any records of them anywhere, and the dates don't line up to Holmes' own timeline. And on top of that, there were another two victims that came forward to claim,
"I have never been killed by anybody, and most certainly not by H.H. Holmes."
So why would Holmes admit to the crimes he never committed?
My guess is he was either enjoying the spotlight or trying to confuse the police.
Confuse the police? Do you think it's possible that the false confessions were an intentional play to try to secure his innocence in court? If the prosecutors tripped up in trial and used false evidence, he might be able to secure his freedom.
That's possible. He was known to be fairly intelligent, so it's possible he thought through the whole scenario like a game of chess.
Though if that's what he was trying to do, it didn't work. In October of 1895, slightly under a decade since he built his murder castle, Holmes was put on trial for the murder of Benjamin Peitzel. And only the murder of Benjamin Peitzel. A half a year later, on May 7th, 1896, he was set to be hung at Philadelphia County Prison. As he walked to his hangman's post, he gave his third and final confession.
Gentlemen, I have very few words to say. I only wish to state that the extent of my wrongdoing in the taking of human life consists only of two women that have died at my hands as a result of criminal operations. I am not guilty of taking the life of any of the three Peitzel children, or the man for whose death I was convicted, and for whose death I am now to be hanged. That is all I have to say.
And with that, Holmes was hung, finally receiving punishment for his crimes. One question that sits in the tip of my tongue, though, is why, in his last breaths, knowing he would die regardless of what he said, did he alter his confession one final time? There was no way at this point to save himself. Was it pride?
It could have been pride, but it could have also been his way of finding amusement in the last moments before death. He knew that his confession would confuse, and it thrilled him to think he would leave behind a legacy of people wondering what really happened. Perhaps we are playing into what he wanted in this exact moment.
This does seem like a sound prediction based on what he wrote in the newspapers prior to his conviction. In one confession, he says,
"And with this, I am thus branding myself as the most detestable criminal of modern times. A task so hard and distasteful that beside it, the certainty that in a few days I am to be hanged by the neck until I am dead seems but a pastime."
What do you make of that?
It certainly seems that he's reveling in the fame.
So he found the experience entertaining?
Quite probably, seeing as he gave so many confessions and even denied having killed but two people in the end. It seems like he was toying with the world, saying, "Look, you'll never know who I am, but you can wonder." And it worked. We're still talking about him today.
And thanks to his confusing confessions, we're left with many questions. One of the biggest is the unsolvable question, just how many victims did Holmes claim?
We'll return to our story in just a moment. Now the story continues.
His confessions are riddled with contradictions, lies, and misinformation, so we can hardly take what he said at face value. Even police reports and eyewitness accounts were contradictory. However, there are several interesting cases that might offer more insight in answering this question. The first is that of Anna Betts. We briefly mentioned her in the last episode as one of Holmes' potential victims. She died in February 1892 in her home in Chicago. In one of his confessions, Holmes claimed he furtively poisoned her.
"Her death was caused by me purposely substituting a poisonous drug for a prescription which had been sent to my drugstore to be filled."
If what he said was accurate, it's possible that he killed a lot more people than we previously thought with this simple drug swap. People went missing a lot around Holmes, and something like poison was easy to disguise. Also around this time was the World's Fair in Chicago. In 1893, over 27 million people gathered in Chicago to celebrate the World's Columbian Exposition. Just before the fair opened, Holmes remodeled his castle into a full-fledged hotel in order to accommodate the influx of guests. With all the people coming and going from around the country, Holmes would have been able to easily pick off people at his hotel without anyone noticing.
"I came in for the fair, but I guess I was so excited by the whole affair, I forgot to pack my prescription. I feel so silly."
"How long are you here for?"
"Only a few days."
"Well, Chicago is a lovely city. You might find yourself staying much longer than expected."
"I wonder."
"Here's your medicine. Make sure you drink the whole thing up thoroughly."
"I will. Thank you."
They weren't locals, so people around wouldn't know when they went missing. It would also be hard for the families to pinpoint Holmes, especially if he was picking off people who stopped in his shops. Given that, it's entirely possible, as some claim, that his victim count was well over 200 people. One of his housekeepers, Mrs. Loomis, also gives evidence to the theory that Holmes was a lot more active inside his murder castle than we have record of. In one newspaper interview, she said,
Holmes would come to me and tell me to pack his things in a valise, as he intended to go to Toronto that night. I would do so, and would suppose that he had left the house and city. The next day, or the day after, I would accidentally meet him walking through one of the upper hallways on tiptoe. He would be surprised and angry when I saw him, but would make some excuse like,
"I missed the train."
Or,
"I just returned."
He was always up to some kind of tricks, and I believe he told me those stories about going away so as to be able to establish an alibi. I have no doubt that at the time he was supposed to be away, he was engaged in the commission of some crimes.
Mrs. Loomis' statement seemed to align with the idea that Holmes was using the murder castle far more frequently than he would have us believe. Why else would he continue to spend huge amounts of money expanding and improving the castle? With all the evidence and eyewitness reports, it seems highly likely that his serial killings were a lot more numerous than reported. Holmes was a man driven by ambition and efficiency. There's little doubt in my mind that if he built a castle designed for killing, that he would exploit it as much as possible. Holmes himself offers a little insight on the matter as well. When addressing the accusation of there being more murders than what he confessed to, he stated,
"The detectives have gone over my entire life. Hardly a day or an act has escaped their closest scrutiny. And to judge that I am guilty of more than these cases which they have traced out is to cast discredit upon their work."
Although on the surface level, it seems like he's denying the claim, we also know that the police were not doing such a hot job of gathering evidence. In fact, during their search, the police almost blew up the castle. Twice. The Times Herald detailed the incident in all its terrible glory.
The workmen started in the rear end of the basement and began to dig deeply. Foul odors of gas and dead oil choked them. A stench like that of decaying flesh made breathing difficult.
"Oh God, what is that smell?"
Soon they came on an intricate mass of pipes, running from where they could not tell. The laborers recoiled from the rush of gas which met them. They stumbled about in the pit which they had dug, sick and gasping. The men were careless. One of them took a chisel and cut through the zinc lining of the tank itself. The gas rushed out with a hissing sound. They blew out their lights and went to dinner, thinking that in an hour it would be safe to work in the tank itself. After eating, one worker came back to the hole with a lighted candle in hand. Suddenly there was a flash of blinding blue light, and an alarm was sent out and firemen rushed in. The firemen started to rip open the tank. While doing this, the search for the bodies of the girls in the basement was clumsy. Should they continue in this manner, they are just as likely to more deeply bury what is hidden than to find it.
And Holmes probably knew this too. If the police kept messing up like this, much of the evidence of Holmes' murders would be lost forever. So why would Holmes compliment the police on their work when it seems so obvious they were entirely incompetent? Regardless of how many victims he did claim, the victims we are sure about paint a pretty good psychological landscape of our first all-American serial killer. Would you mind helping me round this one out?
Of course. Well, first and foremost, Holmes was very likely a psychopath.
Agreed. He was superficially charming and a smooth talker, able to convince people of nearly anything.
Mm-hmm. He also had a high sense of self-worth, as evidenced by his confession stating that he was one of the most important criminals of the time, and was a pathological liar, as we have seen from his plethora of confessions.
We also saw that he lacked remorse or guilt. In his later confessions, he even expressed joy in killing.
Aside from his psychopathy, he placed a heavy emphasis on objects of monetary value. It might even be accurate to say he was addicted to making money, so much so that he would kill to gain more.
Even when the MO changed, his signature of killing for money stayed relatively the same. Holmes himself confesses,
"I had no cause, save the occasional opportunity, for pecuniary gain occasioned by crimes."
Besides gaining money, Holmes genuinely enjoyed the act of killing. And even more than that, He enjoyed experimenting.
But regardless of what happened, he remained calm and careful in the execution and cleanup of his kills, marking him as an organized killer.
He also lavished in media attention.
He would probably love knowing that he's become such an infamous figure.
I'm sure. And Holmes certainly left behind a legacy in his wake. Even before his death, he was a huge media sensation. The newspapers and public ate up his story and eagerly tracked down his confessions, reports, and eyewitness accounts. In fact, it was in part thanks to the media's attention on him that he was eventually convicted for the murder of Benjamin Peitzel. His story was so popular that after his death, some of his old employees tried to turn the castle into an amusement park of sorts, claiming that if you walked through the halls, you would see his ghost. Even today, you can take walking tours of the decrepit building.
Come on in. Come see the haunted home of the most terrible murderer of our time. Admission, only a dime. What about you, Mrs.? Want to challenge your spirit with the ghost of Holmes himself?
The obsession with Holmes runs so deep that there are books, films, and graphic novels that feature him as the main character. Despite his twisted nature and brutal killings, people were, and still are, obsessed.
And I'm sure they always will be.
Why do you think that might be the case? Why does everyone want to know so much about something so wretched?
There's an innate human desire to try understanding how people are different from us. It's the same as being interested in the practices of a different culture or the lives of the wealthy elite on reality shows.
They're people, yet they live such different lives. How could that be?
Exactly. And with a killer, especially one who kills with no remorse, we have a more difficult time wrapping our head around it. Because of that, we keep seeking more information. We want to understand why. Could I be like that? Could my neighbor, my friend? We can't understand it, so we become captive to that deep, dark fascination.
And Holmes certainly took us somewhere dark. Though much of what happened will undoubtedly remain a mystery, what we have learned only demonstrates the twisted potential of man that could be lurking in anyone. Thank you for listening to Serial Killers. Next week, we'll take a look at one of the most famous female serial killers, Eileen Wuornos. If you enjoyed this episode, please tell your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Serial Killers on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory. Or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's PARCAST Network. Have a killer week. Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admire. Serial Killers is written by Jen Enfield Kane and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Jerry Courtney Austin, Mike Capozzi, Al Falick, Nicholas Massu, Manu Narayan, and Stephen Pinto.